Welcome to Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast. I'm Chuck Slatkin, and I'm here with my co-host, Steve Gould. How are you doing, Steve?
Hey, Chuck. Once again, good to be doing the podcast and talking about our favorite subject, movies.
And indeed is the case. And we decided that maybe it would be a good idea to deal with films that actually came out after the Elgin closed. As difficult as that may be for us to perceive, that was a reality. So we've decided that this week we're going to touch a little bit on the films of the 1980s.
Yeah, I mean, and I got to say this, one thing that gave me a real jolt of nostalgia was a film, actually it was 1988 Oscar winner, from Italy, but I said, wait a minute, we should have had Sam Clare in this film. And it was Cinema Paradiso, yeah, with one of our favorite French actors, Philippe Noiret, playing this projectionist who's loved by this little kid. I thought, holy shit, here's a movie theater just like the Elgin in another country.
That's a good way to begin talking about 1980s film, one that in its way was so close to home.
There were so many of these films. I know you and I were kidding about the volume of film. I mean, we'd have a barrel of films to choose from in the 80s, and that had a lot to do with the fact that there were more of the independent studios that were pumping out films for the foreign market as well. And also that studios, I guess, there might have been a malaise that happened, and the 70s was, the whole end of the Vietnam thing and the movies dealing with that. And then a lot of these movies really were kind of upbeat, and they were going for the younger market. I mean, I was thinking of Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and those kind of movies, Weird Science. So those things, I don't know, maybe it'd work. But then on the other hand, as you well know, we could have been running into a roadblock. And I kind of think sometimes, when I look back at what was happening technologically in the 80s, hey, maybe it's good we weren't there, because you remember, and I think one of your sons, I think he even worked at one of the stores, but Blockbuster went gigantic in the 80s. And,
yes, people in my family worked at Blockbuster through their college years. And yes, it was very much something to the point where, people were picking up videos and whatever, and it would never occur to people, oh, this is just going to be a transitory thing. This isn't going to be around for a long time, where people go to the store to get videos. They're going to, pick it up digitally, online, whatever it is.
Exactly, right.
But to me, what I realized, and maybe you're correct, because people wouldn't be, relying on going to a movie theater for the same reason, but just looking at my own behavior in terms of watching films post-Elgin, and realize a lot of what people did is they would go back and see a favorite film of theirs, and certain films they would see, many times, and bring people that they, cared about, like friends, whatever. Hey, check out this film. That was part of what was behind the Midnight Show phenomenon.
Right.
But I look at myself and see how many films I've watched numerous times since the Elgin closed. Some in theaters, but oftentimes a lot, watching them on some kind of, cable TV or video or streaming it or whatever. And it can't be that has changed that much, that there aren't films that people watch, over and over again, because they enjoy it, because there's something about the film that they relate to or whatever. So in a sense, that reality, which was part of what made up the Elgin and the repertory films that we had, you know, people came back and saw them many times. It wasn't just, you know, bringing their friends to see Pink Flamingos. You know, they were coming to see all kinds of films that they connected with and enjoyed, you know, many, many times. And some of the films that you, you know, were talking about, the Breakfast Club, and those are kinds of films that I've watched, you know, many times, you know, over the years, because of the subject matter, performances, seeing, you know, an actor that, you know, evolved into other things in an early role. But I mean, it's not like you have to explain why people, you know, love movies and watch movies. But I think that, you know, looking at the 80s films, it was just, you know, unbelievable. I mean,
phenomenal. Yeah. It really was. And also it started not only in the demographics that studios were making films that might have been skewing a little younger, but also it was, I'm not saying that it didn't happen before, but it really took off in the 80s with the blockbuster phenomenon, you know, where the Indiana Jones started, and then they had the, you know, the sequel and the sequel and Star Wars. I mean, wow. I mean, could you imagine if we went through the first Indiana Jones, and then what was Indiana sort of Doom, and then what was it, The Last Crusade? I mean, you put those movies on at midnight, and we could have been selling Harrison Ford fedoras at the candy stand, you know?
That's true. That's true. And also, you know, it's just this. I mean, to me, one of the films that really impacted upon me when I saw it was a film that didn't necessarily agree with its narrative, but I loved the way it was presented. And it was The Big Chill. And
exactly.
And to me, it was like, well, there's a natural Elgin double bill. You know, the Big Chill and The Return of the Secaucus Seven, natural double bill for the Elgin. That we didn't have an opportunity of doing, because the what was like 83 or something that The Big Chill came out. But to me, that those films were in a line of Elgin type movies that dealt with things culturally. They did it from a well-made film, and would connect with, you know, generations beyond that, you know, to appreciate that movie.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, I was thinking also of movies that were kind of a similar nature, but they weren't necessarily city-fied and one in the country, and they were kind of like dance films. And if we were going to put a double bill together to have people see, you know, what it was like, we could have put Flashdance and Footloose together. I mean, here's Kevin Bacon and Footloose, you know, dealing with the churches in the Midwest. And then there's Flashdance with them all jumping around. And I mean, it was it'd be a fun thing to see.
That's for sure. And another film that, again, I enjoyed for its craft, but really impacted upon me. And again, it's another, was Rain Man. I mean, that was a phenomenal performance. And Amadeus, that was an Elgin type movie, wouldn't you say?
Oh, sure. Right on the money. Right on the money. You know what I was also thinking about was the number of times that we highlighted foreign films, certainly because of the Tuesday French, Wednesday Italian, Thursday Japanese. But we could even do in the 80s, because there were so many movies, we could do even like a Japanese all-nighter. I mean, Kurosawa's homage, Ran, which was a big hit. I mean, all over the country, people were watching it. And then you could throw a few more in. Oshima, he made a movie called Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and of all things, David Bowie was playing a British officer in World War II in a concentration camp. And we could have put that with like Black Rain, which dealt with the aftermath of the atom bomb in Japan. And that was by, maybe you can remember, that was by the director Imamura. And is that the guy that they found a movie that he had made, and it had such a kind of Asian sounding title that they wanted a different title, and we showed it and called it Warehouse? Was it by that guy? I can't remember that. Oh God. So I mean, those
that gone, was some film.
Oh yeah.
Basically, if people can go online and find Warehouse and check that out, don't.
Yeah, please don't. Yes. Yeah. That was a pretty weird time, Chuck, let me tell you.
Did we have a part in coming up with Warehouse, or that was done by the film company?
Yeah. No. They wanted a title, and you and I were thinking about it. And since a lot of the film took place in one of those, we said, why not call it Warehouse?
Yeah. Since Blind Fields was already taken.
As I said, I had noted with the number of African-American films that were really made and made by major studios in the 80s, certainly a lot more. I mean, there were some blaxploitation movies made, you know, in the 60s and 70s, Cotton Comes to Harlem and stuff like that. But I'm talking about really phenomenal movies. But in tribute to someone who has just passed, Sidney Poitier, I think it should be mentioned that a big hit comedy of the 80s with Pryor and Wilder called Stir Crazy was directed by Sidney Poitier. And I know we'd have that on our screen, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Do the Right Thing. Talk about a film that was an 80s film, right?
Oh, yeah. And, yeah. Do the Right Thing.
Spike Lee.
Yeah, he had a bunch of them came out in the 80s. She's Gotta Have It. That was 1986, yeah. You know. And, I mean, Do the Right Thing was a phenomenal film. And I think it took maybe not the country by storm, but certainly in the markets that it played, it really started incredible conversations about race relations. So... And I think maybe we should mention to the listeners some of the films that came out in the 80s that were directed and starring African Americans. Certainly, you can't forget. Well, I wasn't directed by it, but The Color Purple.
Oh yeah.
And actually, the first Oscar that Denzel Washington got was him playing a Union officer in the Civil, not an officer, a Union troop in the Civil War. He was commanded by Matthew Broderick in that, and it was a film called Glory, which was a phenomenally good film. I thought of, after looking at the list of some of these Black films, that we could get a great double bill out of some Eddie Murphy's. There's one that everybody knows, Coming to America, which certainly had litigation with Paramount involved, but as a double bill, something that he had done with Richard Pryor in 1989 called Harlem Nights, which was a period piece about the 30s. So that'd be a great double bill for us.
What about Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah. Oh, amen. What a movie. I can still remember them shoving a potato in the tailpipe in that one.
And you don't mean that euphemistic.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that literally. Well, I mean, there was a couple of films that I think had more of the far-reaching consequences of what they were talking about. That was the Richard Wright film, Native Son. I think that came out in the mid-80s. And also around that time, once again, Denzel Washington playing the journalist that was covering that Stephen Biko thing in South Africa during apartheid called Cry Freedom. So it wasn't just, you know, popcorn movies. And then certainly this isn't my area of expertise, but I think it was a pretty good business, a film in, I think it was mid-80s called Crush Groove, and it was about Def Jam. So there was a whole host of movies that were coming out, one that I enjoyed. I know it was a little lame, but one that I enjoyed with Whoopi Goldberg playing some kind of analyst with some security firm called Jumpin' Jack Flash. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing that. Remember the theater I saw it at, too. Again, getting back to it, I was like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I've probably seen that a dozen times. One of your teeny movies, huh?
Yeah, the teeny tiny movies. No, and so yeah, I Ridgemont High, and it was also a young woman director that directed that. So I'm sorry I can't remember her name, but I was thinking also of somebody who he made it into the lady years, but two movies that I really enjoyed of his. I don't know, maybe it could be a double bill, was Ghost. And that was with Whoopi Goldberg again, Patrick Swayze. And then Swayze was also very, very good in a small film that came out in the early 80s, Dirty Dancing. Yeah.
Well, that could be on the All Night Show with your other dance films.
Yeah, yeah, there's an idea. Or else let's show them Sunday morning.
Or if we're going to show it, we have Saturday Night Fever, which was probably the...
Oh, yeah, quintessential. Yeah, yeah, you're right about that. You know, some of the other movies that, I mean, I loved, as you said, Ridgemont High is really well made. But there were some other movies that were amusing, like Gremlins, Goonies, Weird Science, you know. You know, we could get some
science.
Yeah, we could get some traction out of that. If we wanted to show some a couple of films together that showed a little bizarre nature of impetuous youth, we could show that Fox film Weekend at Bernie's with Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah, that would definitely be a good one. And Big was a movie that was did that really launch Tom Hanks?
Well, I don't know if it launched him, but it certainly made him, you know, the big A-list guy that he became. You know, we had in the 80s the Ghostbusters came out. You know, that took on its own life. So did E.T.
One question about a film that was probably one of the, if not the biggest film of the eight, one of the biggest film, E.T. I mean, does that still hold up? Do people watch that? Is that something that generations still watch?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even in a nostalgic sense, Back to the Future's that way too. You know, that came out.
I understand Back to the Future still holds up and people watched, you know, the sequels and it's shown a lot. I just didn't know if E.T. had that same kind of, feeling.
I don't know. I mean, we'd have to see, you know, what it was grossing now. I don't think that it's public domain yet. So it still is a rental film. But
what about Elephant Man?
I mean, those are the kind of films that I think we would have loved to, because we did have that market on Sunday mornings, whether it was with opera or ballet films or some of the theater films, you know, and Elephant Man certainly would fit into that category. I certainly know that it probably didn't do as well as, I forget what studio released that now, but didn't do as well as they thought it might, because it was a very successful Broadway show.
Oh, Elephant Man, who could show that with Rain Man.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. People would say, I don't understand that. What's that double bill about?
Well, and for an all-night show, he could have shown Elephant Man, Rain Man, and Tootsie. That would have been
really, oh, yeah.
Okay, Tootsie, good. That was a big 80s film.
Oh, Tootsie, sure, yeah. So, and then you have I Feel the Need for Speed, you know, and they had Top Gun, you know, and Cruise is, he was hitting it out of the park, even when he was the young guy in Risky Business. I mean, the 80s, he was the charmer, you know, so.
And then there are other films that you like, maybe just for part of the film, whatever. To me, one of the best openings of a movie was Atlantic City.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the other things that two people who certainly are in the pantheon of filmmakers, Coppola and Oliver Stone. And I was thinking, wow, we could really have a good toe tapper. We could put Apocalypse Now together with Platoon. And I could sell razor blades at the candy stand.
Yeah, but I understood, but they're two phenomenal films. And I would.
Yeah, they really were.
And we shouldn't assume that everybody listening or watching has seen, you know, either or both of those films, and would definitely, you know, recommend them.
Oh, yeah, I'd recommend them. Certainly, they are quintessential. You know, the directors and the actors did a phenomenal job. And also, you know, the thing that I enjoyed, they also tried mix and match on things. And I was really amused with Bob Hoskins when he was in that film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I thought that was pretty amusing. And I always thought, well, Roger Rabbit, you know, we could team it with another one of little urchins, like put a double bill of Roger Rabbit and Gremlins together.
Yeah, that was good. And on an all-night show, we could have that playing with the Raging Bull.
Yeah, indeed. And some of the movies that came out in the 80s that took the Oscar, I mean, it was besides Cinema Paradiso, the movie dealing with people that lost their lives because of the dictatorship in Argentina. 1985, Official Story, was the best foreign film. I mean, that was incredible. And there were two movies that, one of them was best foreign film. The Louis Malle film, Au Revoir les Enfants, but we could put it with a Truffaut film, which actually also dealt with the movie theater when with Catherine Deneuve, the Last Metro, where she took over when her husband was, I don't know, you know, he had to skip town considering the Nazis. So, but those, you know, I mean, that'd be a terrific double bill. And, you know, another twisted double bill that I thought of by someone who was a friend of our late partner, Ben Barinholtz, David Lynch. He made a film in 86 called Blue Velvet, which was quite twisted. And
a powerfully twisted movie.
Yes. And I thought a double bill of with Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill from 1980 would definitely put certain people into a gratifying state of mind.
Well, getting a little more into a mainstream film, but it's something I've been thinking about, because it's a film that at the time I thought it was but really haven't been drawn to watch it again, and that was Stand By Me.
Oh, one of my favorites. One of my favorites. When I see that and those kids walking along the railroad tracks, I mean, yeah. Oh my God! And for Rob Reiner to use that that song with it is just. Yeah. I was thinking there's another movie that deals with youth and alienation of youth. is a movie that would make a great double bill with that one, and that's The Outsiders.
Very good.
Both of those really are phenomenally good films. If anybody wanted to see films of the 80s that was dealing with alienation of youth, both of those are just, can't say enough.
And I just want to put in for the record that the female director was Amy Heckerling.
Yes, Heckerling. That was it. Yep.
But I guess in a sense, if we look at any decade, we're going to find phenomenal films and great films and films that, you know, maybe hold up, dated or whatever. And it's good to look at that, because we really had the opportunity at the Elgin, you know, putting films together from, you know, different decades, different eras, making some kind of, you know, really, you know, strong connections, sometimes almost a tongue-in-cheek connection between films. But, you know, we should, you know, approach that, because people, you know, have the opportunity at home through streaming or whatever to, in a sense, you know, program themselves, you know, because I find myself, when I have the time, I prefer to watch a double bill than just one film.
Oh, I agree. And you know, I was thinking when you had mentioned about Elephant Man, which I did see when it was on Broadway, and that it had not really been boffo at the box office for a movie, something that functioned backwards, that was a super hit in a movie, was Beetlejuice. And they tried to make a musical out of it. And while it wasn't a bomb, it certainly didn't pay off its investors. So going from one medium to another, just because the first was a hit, doesn't necessarily mean that when it transfers to the other medium that it's going to be a hit.
That's understood. Midnight Run, that always felt to me like that would be an Elgin film. Maybe even one that people would come to see over and over again.
Yeah, we have those movies. And you know, I was amazed at the period of time we were doing this, that I wondered, there were a few films that I said, what the hell are people seeing in this movie? But they must have been seeing something, because they were coming back to it.
So I think another film that would hold up as a comedy, and some, maybe it's more difficult for comedy sometimes to hold up, but a film that I remember when I first saw it, and I was thinking, this is going to be, you know, like silly or stupid comedy, and I loved it. And I've seen a number of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That was a 1980s comedy.
Yeah, it was John Candy and Martin. Yeah, that was a super hit that Paramount really paid their stockholders off well with.
I don't mind if they make money as long as I enjoy it.
Right. And I mean, but of course, the movie that became their big pot of gold in the 80s was Airplane. That movie, to this day, you know, I can still picture Lloyd Bridges sniffing glue.
Well done. Well done.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I think we've as what's that term, covered the waterfront.
Right. I think
on the 80s.
I think we've pretty much mentioned maybe the films of the 80s that we'd like to talk about and see, and the impact, I guess, on to the 90s. The
next. Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to do that. I mean, that's it's inspiring to see that even though the Elgin closed, they decided to still make movies after we closed.
I was listening to a thing with Keith Hernandez, the baseball player, and they went into broadcasting, and they said to him, well, you know, were you thinking of broadcasting right away? He says, no, actually, after I stopped playing, I couldn't even bring myself to watch baseball games for 5 years.
Wow.
So I understand that. Again, we'll wrap it up, but I think that you were more engaged in films as an industry after the Elgin than I was. And for me, it was always kind of like a mixed feeling, a certain sense of loss, you know, losing that the freedom to actually, you know, program stuff. But now, you know, I can do it any night for me.
Yeah. And well, you should. We should both do this, and let's hope that the listeners and viewers enjoyed this look at the 80s through the eyes of the Elgin, and that we'll move on the next time to the 90s.
Thank everybody for, you know, tuning in and this episode, and looking forward to future episodes, and see the movies.
We'll see you at the movies, Chuck.
Thank you. Thank you.